You're listening to Ohio V, the World, an Ohio history podcast. Subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. And don't forget to rate and review us. Join the conversation now at Facebook. Here's your host, Alex Hasty.
Guys, welcome back. It's episode 5, Ohio vs. Invention. Today we're going to be talking about Garrett Morgan, the famous inventor, an African-American, son of slaves in Kentucky, who comes to Ohio and creates some of the most important inventions that have ever come out of the Buckeye State, things that we still use today. We'll talk about his life, everything that he overcame to become one of the great inventors of all time, underappreciated in his time. But Garrett A. Morgan. We'll talk with his granddaughter, Sandra Morgan, who's done such a great job keeping his memory alive and really one of the most consequential lives ever lived. The number of lives that he saved with his inventions is still growing. So we'll talk about Garrett A. Morgan and his inventions today. He comes from Ohio, you know, the home of invention, whether it's Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers. I mean, he created flight. Edison created so many things. We'll do an episode about him here in the next couple of seasons. Granville Woods, another great African-American inventor. Charles Kettering in Dayton. Morgan was known as the Black Edison in the press. Like we said, the son of slaves. He shows so much bravery, and we'll talk about some of the really brave acts that he does and just brains to overcome so much discrimination. And his ideas just couldn't be suppressed. They were too good. His invention of what we know now as the modern traffic light that saved so many lives. His invention of the gas mask that, you know, whether it was World War I or, you know, fire departments, so many lives that were saved with Morgan's inventions. Our beer for the episode today is the Cleveland Illuminator. It's from Market Garden Brewery. Morgan from Cleveland, one of our favorite breweries up there, marketgardenbrewery.com in Ohio City, 8.5%. And it's, you know, they call it a strong lager, but it is really good stuff and really a fun place to go to. You can buy their beer, certainly all over Central Ohio, all over Northeastern Ohio, Market Garden Brewery. If you're up in Cleveland, go check that place out. And today we're drinking their Illuminator. They named that for the Cleveland's role of the pioneering of streetlights. We'll be talking about Morgan's traffic light that he invented today, among many other events and inventions. But again, marketgardenbrewery.com. Go check them out. Our couple housekeeping items, you know, quickly, we're asking you to rate and review the show. Just scroll down on your phone if you're listening to us. Right down there, you can rate and review us or give us 5 stars. We're reading your reviews on the air, at least some of them. Our friend William Mount kind of gets double props today. Not only did he review the show, he also helped us troubleshoot some audio and technical issues we're having this week with the pod. So I really appreciate everything Billy does, and go listen to his show, The Sounds of Bustown. We were on last September. You can look up an Ohio V the World episode, but he interviews bands all over Central Ohio and does a lot of other shows as well. But love The Sounds of Bustown. Gets you to hear some new bands and some new sounds. Talk with the artist, really cool. He wrote, "Who knew Ohio history was so entertaining? I would have paid more attention in school had it been as fun and entertaining as Ohio V the World. Alex is a great host, storyteller, and interviewer. Excellent podcast if you'd like to know more about the rich history of Ohio." Thanks, Billy. Those kind of reviews really do help us shoot up the rankings. So if you type in Ohio on iTunes, I think we're about the second podcast that comes up now. We're in there with a bunch of true crime shows that are great and a ton of Ohio State football podcasts that I occasionally listen to as a big Buckeye fan, but it's great to be up there. Anyone who looks for anything about Ohio is being directed to the show, and that's really what we want, to get more listeners and share the history. Also, we're featured in the November issue of Columbus Monthly. They did an article about podcasting and featured our show, Big Picture, and a feature article about Ohio v. the World, so you can go buy that. I picked up a copy at Barnes & Noble. I think even in other parts of the states, you can get Columbus Monthly. Check that out. Really wanted to thank them for featuring the show and so many people that they were able to reach that have never heard of us, and the more the better. And lastly, we were on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, one of a great national history and politics show hosted by our friend Bruce Carlson. We did an episode about Jim Traficant. We did one in season three, and we did another one, a new podcast on his show, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Go look it up. It's got a website, myhistorycanbeatuppolitics.com, or anywhere. It's a very, very popular show, and he's a great host out in New Jersey, lives right over the river from New York. But so glad to be on the show with him, and I thought it turned out great, so go listen to that as well. But that's enough talking about things that aren't Garrett A. Morgan. The subject of today's show, like we said, lived just one of the most important lives of any Ohioans, the son of a slave. We'll talk about his inventions with his granddaughter, Sandra Morgan, today. It's Episode 5, Ohio vs. Invention. Garrett Morgan's born on March 4th, 1877, in Claysville, Kentucky, south of Cincinnati, close to Lexington. His parents, like we said, came from Maryland, were slaves. Morgan, one of their many children, I want to say they had 9 or 11. You know, in Kentucky, during the Civil War and in the Confederacy, no patents could be owned by African Americans. Anything a slave created was property of their master. Garrett Morgan himself, not a slave, but lived during this Reconstruction period. He was one of the great inventors of all time. And so we want to talk about his early years in Kentucky and when he moves to Ohio. We asked his granddaughter, Sandra Morgan, to tell us about his early years.
Well, my grandfather was born in 1877, which was literally within a decade of the Civil War ending, or thereabouts. And he lived in Kentucky. Not much changed for African Americans, despite freedom from slavery. And so his family was pretty poor. You know, my great-grandfather, Sidney Morgan, actually came from Maryland. My great-grandfather left Maryland and came to Kentucky probably as a part of, the slaves that his owner had. The reason we haven't figured out yet and his mother, Eliza Reed, was from Kentucky. Directly. At any rate, they had a number of children. We were actually able to find 9. He was raised in a family that was relatively hardscrabble. They worked hard, and he only had a 5th grade education. He didn't have time to go to school. He had to help out at home. And so he worked hard right alongside his other siblings and his family members. The one thing that we do know is that a number of his siblings, the older ones, moved to Ohio. And one moved to New York, but many moved to Ohio. And they settled around the Oberlin area. They settled throughout Ohio. And that's what gave him the incentive, I think, to strike out and move to Ohio when he was 14. He was 14 years old when he left home and decided to come to Ohio.
Morgan moves to Cincinnati as a teenager. Cincinnati is a couple days' walk away from where he grew up. He decides to cross the Ohio River into the north. It's a bustling city, Cincinnati. Porkopolis, we've done so many episodes about the Queen City, but it attracted many people, not just African-Americans from Kentucky, but African-Americans from all over the country and immigrants from all over the country. We talk with Sandra about his journey to Cincinnati.
Well, one of the things that I like to highlight when I am speaking particularly to children, because they don't realize really what hard life is all about. Yeah. Even the hardest of lives here, I think, in modern times, don't realize how difficult people had it 100 or 150 years ago. And so, my grandfather, I really categorize him as an adventurer, because he literally walked through Kentucky to the Ohio-Kentucky border. paid a ferryman to take him across the river, and then he walked into Cincinnati. There was no cars, there were no scooters, he didn't have a horse. He literally had to walk towards his dreams.
Cincinnati was a river town, right on the border of Kentucky and Ohio, on the border between the North and the South. But there's still an incredible amount of Southern leanings in Cincinnati. There always was. And it really shows the difference between Cleveland and Cincinnati. In Garrett A. Morgan's life, he moves to Cleveland. We'll talk about that move with Sandra. But in the 19th century, Cleveland was definitely a northern urban center. Again, also a bustling, growing economic center. But think about, what borders them. You have Kentucky to just over the river, and you have Cleveland that is closer to Canada, really, than anything else, and really was one of the last stops on the Underground Railroad to get to Canada. Cleveland was not a place that was foreign to African Americans and to former slaves. We talk, they both had huge ports and people from all over the country visiting there and doing business in those two cities, the two most important cities in Ohio, certainly at the end of the 19th century. But we talk with Sandra about the move. He goes from Cleveland to Cincinnati and why he does it.
Cincinnati was a bustling city and there was a lot of action going on there. And I guess he thought it would be a great place to, seek his fortune, give life a shot. But what he found was that in many ways, Cincinnati was the same as Kentucky. The same racial divides existed in Cincinnati, the same prejudices, and in some cases, the same people traveled from Kentucky to Cincinnati in Ohio frequently. And so he really wasn't changing. It wasn't a big enough break for him and a big enough change. And that's when he stayed in Cincinnati long enough to get married and divorced at a young age. And so I think that all of that combined for him to just say it's time to move on. And also by then, big things were happening in Cleveland, and people knew about Cleveland. It had a bustling economy. Their manufacturing was at its zenith here. There was a lot going on intellectually, socially, and from a business perspective, and he wanted to be in the middle of the action.
Morgan gets a bunch of odd jobs, and he's working around Cleveland, but he gets a job at a place called Root McBride. It's this job that really sets him on this arc towards innovation and invention. It was at Root McBride where Garrett A. Morgan would make his first invention.
And when he got here, he came ahead of the Great Migration. So it wasn't as large a community as one might imagine. However, it was still here.
Yeah.
And it was welcoming. He was able to find a room and some place to eat and people who were open and welcoming to him. There was a community. One of the big industries here in Northeast Ohio around the turn of the century was
the textile industry.
Yeah. And so he went to work in the textile factories where there were women sewing, and he was the maintenance man. Root McBride was really an important place for Garrett Morgan in a number of ways. It was a catalyst for his career. It's also where he met my grandmother, Mary Hashek. You could attribute a lot to his success from Root McBride. At any rate, when he was at Root McBride, he noticed that the sewing machines were relatively ineffective just because they were the old-fashioned type with the big pedal that you had to push, and things would get moving nicely, and then the leather belt that moved the machine forward would snap. In the meantime, it was lost productivity for the company and for the women who worked there, because as a reminder, when these women were working in these factories, it wasn't just for fun.
Right.
They were working because they needed the money, and they got paid by the piece. And so if they were not being productive and not sewing, they weren't getting paid. Well, my grandfather thought about these leather bands and how they could be improved, really. And he created a continuous rubber band, literally a rubber band. And he also reconfigured it on the machine so that instead of it just going around and around, which would allow it to flop around and all kinds of things, he did it as a figure eight so that it maintained constant tension going around the wheels, and because it was a continuous band, it didn't break.
Nice.
And it was, you hate to say it was revolutionary, but it, at least it really did significantly improve productivity. It was all around a great idea. And so for his pains, Root McBride gave him a $150 bonus,
nice,
which was huge money in the 1890s. He got a promotion, so he was no longer the guy sweeping the floors. He became the mechanic, you know, for the machines. And they said, well, you know what, we'll patent your, we'll take care of the patent on this, which I'm sure they did. He was not the beneficiary of it, but the really great thing is that it gave him the confidence to know that he was intelligent and that he had great ideas and that he was a young man on the move.
While working at Root McBride, he meets a woman, Mary Hasek, a white Czechoslovakian immigrant. He ends up marrying her, an interracial marriage in the early 20th century. We talk with Sandra about that, but Ohio or not, this was risky. This was scandalous stuff. But they would go on, Mary and Garrett, her grandmother, who she knew very well. They would be married for 55 years. We talked to Sandra about this marriage and so much love in her family.
It was significant. Mary Hasek was a Bohemian seamstress. Her family was from the Czech, I guess we call it now the Czech Republic, mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia, actually from Bohemia, which is a region that is north within the Czech Republic. And her family came here looking for a better life, of course. They lived right off of West 7th Street in the Tremont area.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked downtown at Root McBride as well, because Root McBride is, that building is now the Regional Transit Authority building in downtown Cleveland on West 6th. I think it's on West 6th or West 9th Street.
Yeah, I think maybe West 9th.
Yeah, so they both worked there together. That's how they became acquainted. You know, I'm sure that my grandfather would have been perfectly happy to work at Root McBride at least a little bit longer, as would she have. But when, as their romance blossomed, they were both given an ultimatum by the leadership of the company that, you know what, this is not acceptable. It's not socially acceptable.
Scandalous, yeah.
Yeah, you're creating a scandal. And so if you continue the relationship, you have to leave this company. And I'm sure that that was a line in the sand for both of them. And ultimately, my grandfather said, fine, you know, let's go. And he left. She left, of course, afterwards because they got married in 1908.
And her family wasn't very accepting at first also, right?
No, not at all. In fact, her family was not accepting, of the marriage. And my grandmother was excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church as a result of it, at her own father's request. And her father did not speak to her at all, said that she was dead and not a part of the family anymore. Thankfully, her siblings didn't feel that way and managed to sneak past their father and visit with their sister, Mary. And today, the Hasek's, or the Hasek's, as they're called now, I do have contact with members of the Hasek family.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I think that's a fantastic thing. But at the time, it was very difficult. It was scandalous. They were both, they were both shunned. She was shunned by her family and by her former community. She faced a lot of racism and pushback from the African-American community who said, what are you why'd you marry her? We're not good enough. What's the matter with us?
Yeah, from
you
know, both, who is she? It from both sides.
Yeah, and so she really faced, in my opinion, I have my personal feelings. My grandmother was a saint, and for any number of reasons, but she was one of the people that I was closest to in our family because she lived on after my grandfather passed away, and she lived in our house.
Nice.
And so I learned a lot about my Czechy background and how to behave as a good Czechy girl. But I also learned an awful lot about her life with my grandfather and raising three sons, rambunctious ones, you know, and having a outspoken and really kind of rambunctious husband as well.
Morgan's first major invention would be start a line of products that would follow him for the rest of his life. Even Sandra's father sold this line of products well into his adult years. And it was a bunch of beauty products, hair care for men and women. But we talk with Sandra about his hair relaxer, his first famous invention that made, you know, really made him an inventor, and how it just happened almost out of luck.
Serendipity is the only way to describe it. They had a little shop where she made and sold all of these things. The long and short of it is they sewed. My grandmother did. They went on to hire people and had a little sewing factory. So they were looking for a way to keep the needles from scorching fabric is the long and the short of it. It was a problem that was endemic to the industry. And especially imagine if you're sewing something that's cotton, beautiful white cotton blouses or something, and you're zipping along, the needle gets super hot and it scorches the cotton. That piece is done. So everyone was looking for some way to to keep needles from scorching the fabric. My grandfather was fooling around with chemicals and trying to coat needles, got called away for lunch, wiped his hands on a cloth.
That's and right, yeah.
And when he came back, the cloth was straight, and it was a lamb's wool cloth or something. And he thought, this is interesting. And he spread it on a dog, an Airedale, which flattened out the dog's hair. And he thought, okay, now I think I'll try it on my own head, which I thought was really very adventurous. He tried it on his own hair, and it straightened out. And he said, I think I've got something here. And so that was his first product to market, because don't forget, Madam C.J. Walker and all these other people were also in this marketplace. And he thought, well, gee, I can get into it too. And he created a line of products. He had the Garrity Morgan Hair Refinery, and he had a line of products which included this hair straightener, a black hair oil stain, which is hair dye, that was used primarily by men, believe it or not. It was, he advertised it as being safe for your mustache and everything. He had a number of pomades for growing hair and, doing all sorts of things. And he also had lip balms and lotions, soaps.
Yeah.
He had a full line, and that line of products sold all along the East Coast, north and south, for years. It literally wasn't until 1974 or 1975 when my father, who continued to make and distribute those products, decided to call it quit.
Garrett Morgan worked and invented in a very complicated time. The early 20th century in this country, following the Industrial Revolution, where workers' rights and regulations had not met up with the speed and danger of industry. On March 25, 1911, we had one of our worst industrial disasters. It's known as the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, and it was a fire in New York City. A fire started with a cigarette on the 9th floor. And due to really the tyrannical owners and the lack of workers' rights and regulations by the city, and really working fire equipment, which would Garrett A. Morgan would play a role in improving, 146 people died, mostly teenagers. Fire started on the 9th floor. with a cigarette, and the eighth floor was the shirtwaist factory. Nearly half of these women jumped to their death in front of 1,000 onlookers. All this happened in 25 minutes. Almost 150, nearly all young women died. Firefighters had a number of issues fighting this fire. Their ladders, this fire we said was up on the 8th, 9th, 10th floor. The ladders only reached to the 6th floor. They couldn't enter the building because they didn't have any kind of smoke protection. There were no gas masks in their safety arsenal. Garrett Morgan would see this. The Triangle Fire changed things. It changed work hours, regulations, workplace and safety, workers' rights. We talk with Sandra, about some of these things that are happening around Garrett Morgan as it leads to him inventing his safety hood, the new gas mask.
He listened to the news and read the newspaper like everyone else, and every other minute there was a fire or a building collapse or a chemical explosion or something that was going on, both in businesses and in these big apartment buildings, tenements in the major cities, and people were losing their lives or they couldn't get out. And even the firefighters and policemen, who were trying to bravely save people, could only spend so much time inside because of the smoke, the fumes, right. That sort of thing. And there were all kinds of safety, I'll call them safety hoods, but all kinds of safety devices that were largely ineffective, right? You could go in, but you couldn't stay in very long before you had to come out. Or there'd be something with a big glass plate in the front, and as soon as you got exposed to the heat, the glass would shatter right into the face of whoever was wearing it. There were all kinds of problems with these things. And so, my grandfather was curious, but he also had a very strong sense of public safety.
It was 4:40 p.m., Saturday, March 25th, 1911, when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory became an inferno. Inside the top three floors of this building in downtown Manhattan, 500 men and women, mostly women, mostly immigrants, were stitching their way to a new life in America. Hunched over sewing machines making blouses called shirtwaists, they were about to finish a day's hard labor.
A cutter was smoking a cigarette, and apparently one of the cigarettes dropped, and there's lawn, which is a kind of a thin cotton, and the lawn spread the fire very, very quickly.
As flames swallowed the factory, the crowd below saw women jump from the upper windows. Firemen's ladders were too short, and fire escapes buckled and cracked. At least one door was said to be locked. In all, 146 people died.
The average age of the people who died in the Triangle Fire was 21.
Garrett A. Morgan didn't invent the gas mask, but he certainly improved it and made it one of the first working gas masks. We talked to Sandra just about what Garrett A. Morgan called the Morgan safety hood.
He came up with an idea that ultimately he was granted a patent for. So when he created the Garrett Morgan safety device, the big issue, the big deal, is being able to stay in a space with chemicals and all kinds of bad stuff in the air for a greater amount of time.
To save lives.
And so the Garrett Morgan safety hood hinged on having the ability to draw in fresh air and expel, stale air and have it recycled. And so he created a what is essentially a charcoal filtration pack that was a part of the safety hood so that as you breathed, the air was recycled. It was cleaned. All right, and that's how people. And he also got rid of the, if you see the safety hood, they're eye patches, right? But they're made of mica; they're not made of glass, so they're not going to explode in your eyes. And it was super heavy duty canvas, lighter than some of the previous ones. So his design was lighter. It provided for clear sight while you were inside of a burning building or some such. And it also, and most importantly, filtered air, which significantly increased the amount of time that a person wearing it could spend in a dangerous or noxious.
Very good, noxious.
environment. Yeah.
Garrett Morgan goes to sell his safety hood. He goes to the New York International Exposition of Safety and Sanitation and actually wins first grand prize. But he can't accept it himself. We'll talk to Sandra about that, but the product isn't going to sell if it's being sold by an African-American. So Morgan is there, but he's not Garrett A. Morgan. He's not the one who invented it. He basically hires an actor, from what I can tell. You know, several of those devices were taken. There was a subway disaster underground. The New York Fire Department, he gave them a number of these safety hoods, and they used to go down in the tunnels and help save people. Just when he's there for those couple of weeks for the exposition. We asked Sandra about, you know, the safety hood and its success, and also just the discrimination that kept him from being able to fully enjoy his great invention.
Well, yes, my grandfather took his safety hood on the road. I mean, his plan was to sell it to fire departments and police departments around the country.
What time was it? Like, what year?
This was around 1911 or 12. Mm-hmm. Okay, because he got the patent. He applied for the patent in 1912. Was issued the patent in 1914. Then as now, it takes a little while to receive patents. But in the meantime, he took it to various safety expositions and places. He couldn't go as himself. You know, he had people who went with him to represent him, and those people, you know, were Caucasian because he wouldn't have been allowed to represent his own products right at the time, sign of the times. But at any rate, he took them around to various shows and expositions in order to showcase this product and was quite successful. In fact, the New York Safety Exposition of, I believe, 1911 or 12, he won first prize. And great accolades, and started selling the product.
At the same time as Garrett Morgan's inventing his safety hood, there's a pretty important event going on that would prove that you would need his safety hood. You're talking about World War I. You know, as bodies pile up on the Western Front, and the war becomes a stalemate, a stagnant war, a trench war. You see a reason for Garrett Morgan's safety hood to be on the battlefront. It's at the Second Battle of Ypres in 1915. The Germans are the first to use chemical warfare. It's a horrible thing.
April 22nd, 1915. German forces secretly move thousands of chlorine gas cylinders into position around Ypres. 168 tons, enough to swamp Allied trenches along a four-mile front. The French troops stationed there have no idea what's coming. The Germans begin by opening the valves on nearly 6,000 chlorine gas cylinders. The gas is piped into no man's land, where a light breeze picks it up. In just 5 minutes, a deadly cloud, 4 miles wide, is drifting towards the French line.
These French-Algerian forces and Canadians, who were the targets of this first attack at the Second Battle of Ypres, imagine their terror. They never heard of gas masks or chemical gas. You know, this war that's supposed to be so gallant and brave, and really we start killing people with almost, you know, like aerosols, like we kill a hornet's nest or, how you know, a bunch of ants with Raid. This was a changing of warfare. And there's a number of different accounts, and really we share this with you, really coming from the great podcast Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. You got to go listen to his 5-part series on World War I, Blueprint for Armageddon. It's really what got us into historical podcasting. It's that good. I mean, these episodes are 3, 4, 5 hours long. But he pointed me to a clip, and this is actually from a British soldier who was part of the second attack about a week later. And here's what he said. "Suddenly over the top of our front line, we saw what looked like clouds of thin gray smoke rolling slowly along with the slight wind. It hung to the ground, reaching a height of 8 or 9 feet, and approached so slowly that a man could have kept ahead of it. Gas, it was yelled out. The word quickly passed around. Even now, it held no terror for us, for we had not yet tasted it. Suddenly, though, through the communication trench came rushing a few khaki-clad figures, their eyes glaring out of their heads, their hands tearing at their throats they came on. Some stumbled and fell and lay writhing in the bottom of the trench, choking and gasping. Those following trampled over them. If ever men were raving mad with terror, these men were. Our biggest enemy now was a few yards ahead of us, in the form of clouds of gas. We caught our first whiff of it. No words of mine can even describe my feelings as we inhaled the first mouthful. We choked, spit, and coughed. My lungs felt as though they were being burnt out and they were going to burst. Red-hot needles were being thrust into my eyes. The first impression was to run. It was one of those occasions when you not know what you were doing. The man who stayed was no braver than the man who ran away. We crouched there, terrified, stupefied. Think about the terror. Hundreds would die in that attack. There was almost a 6-kilometer gap after the first usage in the line. These lines that had held strong for, you know, the better part of 6 months, 8 months. Not only was their gas from the Germans, they also were firing artillery. When you got up out of the trench, they were shooting machine gun fire. If the Germans had known it was going to work so well, they would have exploited it more. It could have been a huge breakthrough instead of a minor breakthrough in the war. And it could have, you know, wrapped up maybe the Western Front if they had played it better. Soon both sides are using this gas. We talk with Sandra about how her grandfather, Garrett Morgan, and his safety hood gas mask would actually be given to the government. And it's patent used as part of America's forces in their use of gas masks in the war.
You know, the war broke out, and that he actually gave the patent to the government. He allowed the government to use that patent in order to make the safety hoods because he felt that it was just that important,
yeah.
You know. And so, and he continued to sell safety hoods, you know, beyond giving the patent to the government. And so it really didn't hurt him at all to give away the patent. It was his honor to give it to the government.
We spoke earlier about the bravery Garrett Morgan showed during his life, and I think he showed daily bravery to overcome the discrimination and people trying to hold him down. But he certainly showed a particular bravery when we talk about what's called the Lake Erie Crib Disaster. The Lake Erie Crib Disaster, July 24th, 1916. At 10 p.m. at night, they built these giant, and we'll have Sandra explain it, but basically to get clean water into Cleveland, they went way out and way under Lake Erie to bring in this water that wasn't contaminated. And they'd be able to filter it to those, you know, throughout the city. You know, I'm talking 250 feet under the lake, you know, going out miles out to the lake even. Building these tunnels. But there's a disaster. They were called cribs. There's a disaster in the summer of 1916, and Garrett Morgan comes to the rescue. We talked to Sandra about the Great Lakes crib disaster.
And we celebrated 103 years now. I mean, it happened on July 25th, I believe, was the date of the Great Crib Disaster. The long and the short of it is that at the beginning of the century, 1916, the city of Cleveland was growing, and there was a huge need for expansion of infrastructure. And so they were building out water filtration lines in order to support new water filtration plants east and west for the city of Cleveland. And so the crib is actually an underground. They were digging under Lake Erie, meaning underground in Lake Erie, in order to lay pipes that would allow for fresh water to come in. You know, and to be able to circulate water is what it was.
Yeah,
to allow fresh water to flow in and to allow filtrated water to, I guess, flow out, right? To create this ecosystem that would allow us to draw on water whenever we need it. Because, again, the city of Cleveland was growing by leaps and bounds. And the fact of the matter is that there was a lot of there were a lot of issues with the way that it was managed in the first place. This was pre-union and that sort of thing.
Dangerous work.
Yeah, so it was very dangerous work. The men who were doing this work were primarily immigrants, mainly Irish. They called them sand hogs because they would go out on the lake and do this really very dangerous work, and for little or no money, frankly. And they were considered expendable, which is hard to imagine that human life would be considered expendable. And yet, here we are. So there was a lot of complaining before the Cribs disaster actually happened about safety conditions both on shore and at the crib or the station that they were working from
underneath the lake,
right? Because it was literally 5 miles out from the shore and under the lake. I personally would be frightened to death to be under there, but they were down there and they were digging, and they were digging with shovels and, I mean, they picks, and you know, this was not high-end machinery that they were using. This was backbreaking work, and it was hot and dangerous. And so they hit a gas pocket down there, and it exploded. And of course, then it filled the tunnels with noxious fumes. And so as they were wiring back, saying, help, 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 you know, we're stuck under here, and people were already dead because they had died in the explosion, but this was life or death. We really need to get down here. And so they sent people out. They sent a rescue team out to the crib, and the minute that they got down into the shaft and the shaft doors opened, well, of course, the noxic fumes knocked them out too, literally knocked them to their knees before they could even get out of the shaft. And that was that.
You know, two teams have gone down. 11 people are already dead. Garrett Morgan's being called upon. You know, they bring him and his safety hood's over. I would have just been like, here you go. Here's a couple of the hoods. Good luck. But his brother Frank and him are brought to the scene, and they go in. Someone else, I think their father-in-law was down there. It might have been another man, another white man that goes down with the two Morgan boys. But the four-man rescue crew goes underneath the crib. We talked to Sandra about that rescue and how crazy and brave that was of Garrett Morgan.
Utter chaos. It was mayhem and chaos is the best way to describe it. And finally, someone said, hey, this guy Garrett Morgan with these safety hoods, you know, he's hawking them all over the place. We've seen them.
He's living like kind of on the Near East Side, right?
Yeah, he lives in Cleveland. Let's call him and get him down here with those safety hoods. And so they called my grandfather on the phone, told him what was going on. He gathered up and told him, you know, hurry up. He was still in his pajamas because it was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He gathered up a bunch of the safety hoods out of his, you know, inventory, and went and got his brother Frank, okay, who was also in his pajamas, and said, hey, come on, let's hurry it up and get down here. We've got to do this. And so he and Frank arrived, and when they got there, they told him, okay, you know, go down there, and if you can get out of the shaft and see what's going on, you're gonna have to wear your bare feet. Okay, no shoes and no boots. And that's because there were live wires everywhere.
Right, that's gonna
and
trick
he
them.
Needed to yeah. And he needed to be able to feel around, if he couldn't see, feel around with his bare feet to know where to step and how to move. And you're right, not to create any friction that would cause secondary
or
tertiary explosions.
Yeah.
And so I can't even imagine the way that he felt, his heart racing, heart beating in his chest, wondering if this was going to be it, his demise, if he was going to live or die, and not knowing what to expect when he got to the bottom of that shaft.
I mean, it's just when you so I get a little claustrophobic sometimes. I just can't imagine. I'm sure, did he know that he was going to Couldn't he have just given them the hoods and they had?
Well, the thing is that they didn't. There was a lack of confidence, shall we say, from some of the volunteers that were there. I mean, they knew what had happened to the other volunteers
right,
that had gone down.
Back,
they
yeah.
didn't come back, and they were scared. And so, you know, it was sort of a, you know, they were throwing down the gauntlet. If your safety hoods work so well, why don't you go down and then come back, and then we'll see. Which is exactly, by the way, what he did. He went. He and his brother Frank went down the shaft. I think that they convinced one other guy to go down with them. They all went down. Opened the shaft doors, and there was mayhem. You know, people were moaning and crying and screaming, and there was blood and there was smoke and everything. And what they did was they looked around. They had one of those big carts, you know, the big rolling carts that use for any number of things, and they literally loaded the dead and dying into whatever was close by into the cart.
Those little mining carts,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And for those people who were still alive, you know, the ones that were seriously hurt, and then the ones that were still alive, they got everybody kind of organized, and that was the first trip out. Get the people who were alive out first, the people who are alive but hurt, and then, you know, padded with some dead bodies, unfortunately. They came up, and people were astonished. They were astounded that they actually made it back up. And, of course, then people were, you know, they were telling their stories, and it was pandemonium up on the shore then as well. And so men quickly grabbed the safety hoods. They went down in the shaft. And after several trips back and forth, they were able to bring the men back up. They got all of the men who were alive, of which there were about nine. They brought those men back up first. Those who were, and let me qualify that by saying who were alive and able to actually manage themselves.
Yeah.
Those who were alive but, you know, seriously hurt or dying, got those men out, and then the rest was just, you know, picking up bodies, getting their bodies out of the shaft so that they could have, you know, an honorable burial, so that they weren't just buried down underneath the lake.
There's a picture. You can find it online. A picture of Garrett A. Morgan holding one of the men that they rescued. The safety hoods worked. They actually pulled six men who were alive at the time out of the crypts. Only two of those would actually survive, but still an amazing accomplishment. And this picture on the Plain Dealer shows Garrett Morgan, you know, carrying one of the victims. But he get no recognition. The article barely mentions him and his brother. You know, just another example of just terrible racism in Ohio here in the early 20th century. Much like with the safety hood where he had to hire a white actor, this time he is actually there. It's people, hundreds of people saw what he did, and still no recognition. And, you know, Garrett wouldn't take it lying down, but the mayor just put a stop to it, wouldn't acknowledge him. You know, they actually, the guys who went down with him, the white guys, were given awards, I think $500, hailed as heroes, but not Garrett Morgan.
It was him. I mean, he was in the center of the photo.
Yeah.
And yet, there was a significant pushback on recognizing him
and his brother as
heroes in this. They barely mentioned the Garrett Morgan safety hood, let alone that he and his brother were there. And so several other men, you know, they were named as the heroes of the program, and instead of the rescue, instead of even saying, well, thanks to Garrett Morgan's safety hood or anything, they went with it. They didn't say one word and did not acknowledge my grandfather. And when they were handing out medals, you know, the Carnegie Foundation gave out medals to all the men and cash to all of the men who were considered heroes of this you know, this great tragedy. My grandfather was not among them, and no one stood up for him to say that he was there.
Garrett Morgan keeps on inventing. and in the late teens and early 1920s, cars become prevalent across the country. But, you know, cars enter this world of people who would, you know, would still walk, bicyclists, horses and buggies, you know, men on horse. I mean, it was so dangerous driving a car when they first came out. People died by just the handfuls. You know, the streets, there's, you know, very little street signs, inexperience with, you know, road safety. Garrett Morgan sees another growing problem of people in his community dying. And he actually sees it firsthand. We talked to Sandra about, you know, this story that's passed down through her family, about, you know, really what drove him to try and make the first modern tripartite, three-part traffic light.
By then, my grandfather was established, you know, businesses and everything else. But you're right, at the turn of the century, there was a lot going on the roads. You know, cars, wagons, horses, pedestrians, everybody. And the turn signals or the traffic signals of the time were pretty much stop and go. All right. It was, you know, you're either moving or you're not. And the big issue then as now is with the intersections. OK, it's usually around an intersection. You don't know whether to stop or whether to go, what to do. And especially if there's a lot of traffic flowing in out of the intersection, it was a recipe for disaster. And it usually was. And so my dad and my Uncle John were in the car with my grandfather when they witnessed this accident. And it was between another automobile and a horse-drawn wagon. And, of course, the horse was fatally injured. They had to kill the horse, right, there on the road, which, of course, was traumatic for little kids.
Sure.
And there was a little girl that was in the wagon, and she was hurt pretty significantly as well. She was thrown from the wagon, you know, and into the street. And so it was a terrible accident. And my father and my uncle, you know, recalled it quite vividly all of their lives. So it must have been really horrific. And that made my grandfather think, again, there were traffic signals that were available. You know, there were handhelds, there were, you know, ones with levers, there were all kinds of traffic signals, but their main focus was stop and go. All right. And there were a couple of things, you know, that were wrong with that. You didn't know, first of all, if you're a police officer and you're in the middle of the road holding something that says stop and go, you're in imminent danger at all times, right? And number two, it's the turn of the century, but everybody doesn't know how to read.
Yeah.
Okay, so if my grandfather used to say, according to my dad, what does stop or go mean to a horse? Nothing, right? And if the rider of the horse can't read, it still doesn't mean anything. So anyway, the long and short of it is that my grandfather decided something needed to be done. And his idea was not to invent a new traffic signal. It was simply to create an improvement on the ones that already existed. And the improvement that he got the patent for in 1923 was really what we call now the caution light. It is the third position of the signal. So, you know, stop, okay, go, okay. But the third position was caution. All right, if you're in the intersection, get out of it. And if you're not in the intersection, don't go in, right? So if you're...
Something's about to change.
Yeah, something is about to change. And so that was the revolution of his traffic signal, and it still holds today. I mean, there have been all kinds of improvements, obviously, to the traffic signal since my grandfather's patent in 1923, but the foundational caution or something is about to change is the constant in every single traffic signal that we see around the world today.
This invention, though, would be the one, the moneymaker. The one that allowed him to retire comfortably. We talked to Sandra about, you know, getting the patent for the traffic light. And why did he decide to sell it?
He sold the patent. First of all, he was smart. He got the patent in the UK, in Canada, and in the United States. So he felt he had like a world monopoly on this patent. But he ultimately sold it to General Electric, you know, for their manufacture. Because, you know, being an independent inventor, then and now, it's very difficult to manufacture your product.
Yeah.
And so for him, it would have been virtually impossible to manufacture the product, so he sold it to General Electric in 1924 for what we would think now is peanuts, $40,000, but at the time was the equivalent of several million,
yeah.
and that allowed him to essentially, you know, take it easy.
It's generational wealth at that point.
Yes.
It's around this time where the press starts using the phrase the Black Edison to describe Garrett Morgan. It's not something that he called himself, but we talked to Sandra about this nickname for the great inventor.
I think that might be a kind of a media creation.
Seems like it, yeah.
Yeah. I think he was certainly interested in Edison and what was going on here in Northeast Ohio, but I don't think it's because he considered himself necessarily the Black Edison. I think that was a name that was given to him. I think he was just interested in being Garrett Morgan.
Garrett Morgan continues to live in Cleveland. He continues to invent. He's inventing into his 70s. We talk with Sandra about some of his later inventions. He's still doing it. He's still getting patents.
He continued to get patents throughout his life and his career. And one of them was for, as an example, a pressing comb, a hot comb, that African-American or really anyone who had really curly, thick hair could use. And the tines on it were curved so that you could get closer to the root of your hair, to your scalp, and not without burning yourself or touching your ears or anything like that, right? And straighten your hair. And that was and that was pretty popular. It seems really kitschy, but, you know, a great seller. And made him good money, you know, as a part of his hair care dynasty. He also invented, because, again, people smoked in bed.
Everyone smoked.
Lots of people smoked. People would smoke in bed, and they would set their mattresses on fire and all kinds of drama there. And so he invented a little filter that went inside of the cigarette that was liquid, and I'm not sure what the chemical makeup of that was. It wasn't water, but it was such that if you were smoking a cigarette and you forgot to put it out, when it burned down to almost the filter, it would self-extinguish.
Wow.
And that's something, you know, believe it or not, we've never seen that in cigarettes, but in China, because people continue to smoke heavily there and they also smoke in bed and create giant fires, it's actually a patent that a couple of cigarette companies have looked into again.
Garrett Morgan would die in Cleveland in 1963. He lived to be 88 years old. And although he didn't get maybe his due in his time, certainly now, if you travel around the city of Cleveland, you'll see a number of remembrances and honorariums to his life. If you go to the Western Reserve Historical Society, where our guest Sandra Morgan's still very involved, they have all his papers donated by the family. They do exhibits and again, have all those different Garrett Morgan artifacts. We ask our guest Sandra Morgan, where in Cleveland can you see some of these remembrances of her grandfather?
There are a number of places. Number one, one of my favorite places in town is the Garrett Morgan School of Science and Math, which is a high school, part of the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, and with a focus on science and math, that is on the near west side. 38th and Woodbine, I think, is where that is. There are plaques and dedications to him throughout the city of Cleveland on various buildings. As an example, you'll find something in City Hall. You'll find something in Public Hall. You know, you'll find plaques hither and yon. The water works, the water filtration plant, is named after Garrett Morgan. And there are statues and things, you know, all around town that showcase my grandfather and his commitment to this community.
And as we close here today, talking about Garrett Morgan, it was in 2016 where he finally was recognized. Sandra Morgan accepted on his behalf an award for his role in the Lake Erie Crib disaster. You know, in his contributions to not just his inventions, but his contributions to public safety and to the city of Cleveland and its people.
And so the Westerly Water Filtration Plant is named the Garrett Morgan Water right. Filtration Plant, and that actually happened under Michael R. White. Mayor Mike White named that facility after my grandfather in the 1980s, but we were happy to be able to celebrate again in 2016 with Mayor Frank Jackson. In 2016, I was really honored and pleased to be able to accept an award on behalf of our entire family in recognition of my grandfather's contributions to that day, you know, the Great Crib disaster, but also his contributions to public safety and public health throughout his career.
From Garfield's tomb to the Serpent Mound, from the big cities to the river towns, first in flight making history, there's so many books you need to see. I like reading, and I like reading. Tippecanoe and Tyler too, from the Queen City to Lake Erie Blue, Edison and a man on the moon. So many books, which will we choose? I like reading. I like reading.
That'll do it for today's episode, guys. No book recommendation. There's really no great books about Garrett Morgan. There are some books if you have kids. There's some great books for teens and children that you can look into and share his story with your children. But no real book. Today, we'll just tell you, go listen to Hardcore History by Dan Carlin. Just came out the new episode, which is a big deal because he only comes out with these free episodes about every 7 to 9 months. He's doing third part of his Supernova in the East episode about the rise of the Japanese in the 20th century. We're now into World War II. But go back and listen to his Blueprint for Armageddon, his World War I podcast that really helped push him to prominence. It is some of the best stuff. And like I said, it's one of the things that really did motivate us. And again, the name of the show, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. We really advise you to go listen to that. Thanks again for joining us, and thanks so much to our guest, Sandra Morgan. She was awesome meeting us up in Northeast Ohio to sit down for an hour and talk about her grandpa's fascinating life. Our next episode, we're going to go back to the pre-Civil War and talk about the abolitionists. Two of the most famous abolitionists came from Ohio. We'll talk about John Brown and his raid of Harper's Ferry and how that started the Civil War. We'll also talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe and how her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and her life in Cincinnati, as President Lincoln said, so you're the little lady who started this great big war. We'll talk about two of the leading abolitionists and the abolitionist movement in Ohio and how it sparked the Civil War. That'll be next time, episode 6. But thank you again so much for joining us. Rate and review the show on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook. And again, you can listen to our most recent guest appearance on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, talking about Jim Traficant. Really had a lot of fun. Thanks again to Bruce Carlson for having us on. If you have any questions, ideas for the show, email us at ohioviewtheworld@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast.